Good morning to you all, and welcome to the second lecture of the 2017 Palliative Care Lecture Series. Hospice New Zealand would like to thank and acknowledge Genesis Oncology Trust for their generous support and funding to deliver these free lectures. The lecture today will be recorded and made available on the Hospice New Zealand website. Please be aware there will be an opportunity for questions at the end of the presentation. I'd now like to introduce and hand over to our guest speaker today, Mr. Martin Woodbridge. Martin is a consultant with Woodbridge Research, Bringing the Knowledge Gap. Welcome, Martin. Please go ahead.
Oh, very good morning to you all. My name is Martin Woodbridge, your presenter, and I'm here with our colleagues at Hospice New Zealand Wellington. In this presentation, I will provide objective, science-based review of cannabinoid therapeutics, an aggregate of my experience. Since university, my passion has been understanding drug function and the quality use of medicines. My career path has revolved around this, including as a clinical pharmacology researcher with Wellington Medical School, moving on to as a science advisor with MedSafe and then the Ministry of Health. More recently, as a consultant, and in particular in this field, I've provided regulatory affairs advice to Bedrocan, the Netherlands pharmaceutical company, and the TGA, the Therapeutics Goods Administration in Australia, on quality aspects of these medicines, alongside providing education and evidence-based information to Australian health professionals. Given cannabinoid therapeutics are essentially a new class of medicine, I think it's important that in this lecture I cover some of the less discussed topics. Hopefully I will uncover some of the myths and again just discuss the really chief aspects of the symptom management. So I'll cover the topics: why cannabinoid therapeutics, patient use here and in the Netherlands, a little bit on pharmacology, then discuss its relationship to palliative care and its clinical use. And then I'd like to delve into pharmaceutical quality aspects. What does make a quality cannabis-based medicine? And I'll talk about administration and then a little touch on accessibility here in New Zealand. When I move through the presentation, I will say next slide and I will introduce the title at the top of each slide. Some of the slides have an extra pop-up, so at that point I'll say please move forward. I'll start now. The use of cannabinoids in symptom management. Next slide. Why cannabinoid therapeutics? Well, a need, evidence, and a therapeutic product existed. So in 2007, the current government at that time requested the Ministry of Health look into this, develop some guidelines, and explore the opportunities of potentially introducing cannabinoid therapeutics to New Zealand. So my role there was to develop the therapeutic guidelines for cannabinoids. And it was a lengthy process because relatively little was known about it at that point in time. I worked closely with clinical leads in palliative care, GP oncology pain, alongside my colleagues at MedSafe to produce guidelines, and that cross-professional review of those guidelines occurred. At the same time, I was liaising with the pharmaceutical company GW Pharmaceutics to ensure that we had a high-quality product available. And probably most importantly was engaging and informing the minister, because at that time we had to have a seamless introduction through robust regulatory guidelines. After that time, I departed from the ministry and I undertook a small consultancy job for them and I went to the first cannabinoid therapeutics symposium held in London by the Royal Pharmaceutical Society. It was the inaugural symposium on that, and met some very interesting people from around the world who were leads in this area. Also travelled to Aberdeen and met with Dr. Pertwee, went to the actual site of GWW Pharmaceutics to see how they are manufacturing the medicine, alongside a range of other important meetings So I generated a report at that time to look at the future of cannabinoid therapeutics. Next slide. Why? Why now? Why do we need to look at this again? Well, further need exists now with greater supporting evidence and therapeutic options. There are pharmaceutical quality in regards to good manufacturing practice of cannabinoid therapeutics and in various administration formats. There's greater clinical insight and clinical research around different indications. And we've had a decade of use of cannabinoid therapeutics in New Zealand. From palliative care setting, I'll mention this in more detail later. Over in Australia is a clinical research undergoing at the moment looking at the use of these products specifically in palliative care. Next slide. Patient use. This information relates to a consultancy piece of work I did for the Ministry of Health in writing up the New Zealand Health Survey, and specifically I made a point to delve into the data around the medicinal use of cannabis. And so this is looking at patients using illegally sourced cannabis. And despite its illegality, 42% of cannabis users reported using it medicinally to treat pain, anxiety, nerves, depression, and nausea. A really large group of people. So whether all of that, 42%, is legitimate medical use is an important question to ask, but nonetheless, it is supposed, from their perspective, medicinal use. Next slide. Patient use. Again, the problem with unregulated products, illegal cannabis, is that it is a botanical substance and can vary greatly in its cannabinoid content from one plant to the next and batch to batch. Moreover, this can lead to inconsistent and unpredictable effects. And often, illegal cannabis contains pesticides, heavy metals, and toxic molds and fungus, which is unacceptable for patient use, particularly in the palliative care setting. Next slide. Patient use, New Zealand. So since 2008, when the Sativex was approved for use in New Zealand, and the guidelines that I wrote were generated for practical use, 104 applications as of 2016. So we're up to around 106 applications to prescribe Sativex have now been approved, and mainly this has been prescribed off-label. So it's a pharmaceutical product, Sativex. It's sprayed under the tongue. It's a sublingual administration. And practically, back in 2007, it was what was seen as the most standardized product, and given its administration dose form, probably the best product for use. But we've found over the last 10 years, this product really hasn't met patient needs. It's an expensive drug product, including the fact that it's, because it's an extracted medicine, it's a Class B controlled substance requiring pharmacy to store it in a locked fridge, another compliance cost, which adds to the overall cost. And finally, in terms of not meeting patient needs, I think it's both the fact that it's not a herbal product, which tends to be of what patients want. They have that kind of general insight that it's a better product, a herbal product, but moreover, the extraction, I think the dose form has a THC and CBD component, perhaps isn't meeting their needs pharmacologically. Next slide. Patient use, the Netherlands. Now, I draw on the Netherlands as an example because they have, it was one of the first jurisdictions internationally to implement a medicinal cannabis program, and it's been running since 2003, but they have delivered standardized products prescribed by doctors and dispensed by pharmacists since that time. And as a result, they've been very sensible in generating good patient use data and clinical information. And so we know from them that half the patients that are prescribed and use these medicines also use pain medication, psycholeptic drugs, analgesics, and anti-ulcer agents, and NSAIDs. I think it's important to highlight that medicinal cannabis from this patient population is slightly different to the information that we've generated from the New Zealand Health Survey, is that medicinal cannabis for these patients relieves their pain, stimulates appetite, reduces nausea, and improves their sleep. And this kind of leads me to the thinking as well that potentially these patient populations are very similar to the needs and wants, potentially, of palliative care setting. Next slide, pharmacology. Now, I've got two graphical representations here. One is of poppies, opium, and one is of cannabis plant, cannabinoids. And I use this as a representation because not that I want to directly compare opioids with cannabinoids, but rather to point out that there are defined, like opioid receptors and that receptor system, there is a defined endocannabinoid system, and its role is in the homeostasis of bodily function, so regulation of appetite, sleep, pain, inflammation. And like opioids, we now have good understanding of their receptor system. So there's two receptors, and CB1 in particular is most prominent receptors in the brain. We have both a good understanding of the endogenous, so the internal ligands that activate the receptor, like we do with opioids. And so we also have access to standardized exogenous ligands. So for opioids, that could be morphine. For cannabinoids, that's THC and CBD. And these have been identified and isolated. So the whole system has been well understood. And I think this is now we've got the point where that level of understanding really substantiates a lot of the clinical data that's coming up. Next slide. CB1 receptor concentrated areas. So there's more than just those I've highlighted within our brain and brain stem. However, I'm highlighting these four in particular because of their relationship to nausea, appetite, pain, and emotion. So the cerebral cortex, higher cognitive and emotional functions, CB1 receptors have an influence, and their activation has an influence on emotional function, and perhaps that may have some role in improving people's general well-being in terms of their thought processes and way they're feeling as a result of their current symptoms. The hypothalamus has a direct relationship on appetite, the CB1 receptor, spinal cords on peripheral sensation and pain sensitivity, and the medulla oblongata, looking around the concepts of nausea and vomiting and the role that CB1 and the activation of those receptors, either via the normal processes of our endogenous cannabinoids or the use of exogenous ligands like those extracted from the cannabis plant. So an interesting grouping of receptors in our brains and the role that potentially they play in modulating our health and well-being. Next slide, pharmacology. This is a graphical representation of when we're moving more from the right down to the cellular level, and we're looking at the neurotransmission and role that both phytocannabinoids and endocannabinoids play in modulating or influencing synaptic neurotransmitter release. I won't go into too much detail here because really it's more important that we get a wider understanding of their use in clinical studies. So from that perspective, I think it's important we move ahead to clinical trials and the review of data. So we've got, in the last slides, I think we've got a good understanding of pharmacology, the fact that these medicines have a practical base in science and have been well identified from a neuropharmacological perspective. but what does that mean from a clinical use perspective? So two colleagues of mine in the Netherlands have undertaken in two batches, reviews of the last 10 years of clinical studies, and these are looking at products that are standardized. So between that time, we've had 69 studies and around 6,000 patients incorporated within them. And the vast majority is looking at chronic pain. And as you'll see, that is as the most researched topic, but spasms and then palliative care aspects and then appetite, nausea and vomiting, sort of slightly separate to the other appetite aspect. What's really interesting is that among patient use surveys indicate that pain is the main indication for the medicinal cannabis use. And so that's been replicated in essence in clinical trial data. And we move ahead. Next slide, palliative care. So thinking about palliative care in relationship to those clinical data, from my perspective, I'd like to highlight from the WHO definition of palliative care two real points that stick out to me is that palliative care provides relief from pain and other distressing symptoms and to enhance the quality of life. Next slide, palliative care settings. Compared to most other patients, the doctor-patient relationship is more intensive and structured. Prescribing is well planned and monitored. The risk of medicine diversion for misuse may be less, and adverse drug reactions are possibly more readily identified and resolved. So when we're looking at a relatively new class of medicines like medicinal cannabis or cannabinoid therapeutics, it's really important to understand where do we introduce these, how do we properly structure it so we can have a safe introduction. And I think palliative care ticks a lot of boxes in particular because of those points just highlighted. We think back to the last slide where we're looking at palliative care role in particular around pain relief and enhancing quality of life, and we think about the role of a medicine in that, then I'd like you to look to the right of the slide and which describes palliative care related prescriptions by category. And my apologies, this data is drawn from Palliative Care Services Australia, as I was unable to secure well updated New Zealand data. But let's put it in perspective and consider that these are the chief points. You'll see analgesics, antiepileptics, laxatives, psycholeptics highlighted there as being among the most prescribed. Antiemetics has been taken off the palliative care schedule in Australia, so the number of prescriptions have dramatically decreased over time. But from a palliative care perspective and thinking about the role that prescribing plays in relieving pain and heart and quality of life, let's look at analgesics and antiemetics. Next slide, well-being, appetite, and nausea. So from that, from looking at antiemetics in particular, there is a relative lack of evidence about the safety and efficacy of cannabinoid-based therapeutics in this setting. And in particular, we do need to know more about how to optimize the dose, the best mode of administration, the time that peak levels occur and the length of time that they're active. Next slide, clinical trials. Well, as I mentioned, the Australian New South Wales clinical trial is currently being conducted to explore just that. And so this is the first of its kind in the world and in particular in Australia. It's a double-blind, randomised control trial led by Professor Mira Agar, which I'm sure many of you know. And she and her team are going to explore whether vaporised medicinal cannabis floss, so whole dried flower as a standardised product, can promote appetite and improve their quality of life. So the vaporised cannabis floss as I'll talk about later, eliminates the respiratory effects or risks of smoking, allows a reliable dosage to be ingested or taken in, and is suitable for patients who find swallowing difficult. And the study protocol itself is going to be very interesting. It will deliver quite brilliant information for us to further understand how to administer these products. And it will deliver therapeutic concentration of cannabinoids before meal times. It will profile the cannabinoids in the bloodstream after the dose and examine the impact on appetite-related symptoms and examine the impact on their quality of life. So as we know, people with cancer, the pathways that promote their appetite are disrupted and the quality of life is reduced due to fatigue, low mood, nausea and insomnia, aspects which are really critical to health and well-being. So this study, which we expect some preliminary results fairly soon, will really highlight some great information from that perspective. Next slide, pain, clinical data. So from the perspective of pain, what does or do cannabinoid therapeutics offer us? Well, THC or delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol and CBD, cannabidiol, is effective in chronic pain, chronic cancer pain relief alone, and importantly, this is the point, when added to a standard opioid therapy. And I'm drawing again from the Hayes Camp and Calwell reviews. THC may target the effective quality of pain instead of simply reducing pain intensity, and CBD may modulate the effects of THC. And that data is really coming to fruition now. I think we're getting to understand the role that CBD may play in terms of bolstering THC's effect. The interactions, so we're starting to think, okay, we've got an understanding about what THC CBD does in terms of pain and also in terms of appetite and well-being, but these interactions between the two really highlight the complexity of studies on cannabis-based drugs. Furthermore, it makes us think, well, what are the practical applications? We have products available that are THC alone, but sometimes patients are finding these too harsh, too psychoactive. And so that's why many patients actually find the use of cannabis floss or the herbal product more useful and easy to engage with as a product because of the risk of side effects are substantially lower than a THC alone. And the potential synergy that occurs when you are intaking the terpene compounds which are combined in the cannabis floss flower and what that impact has on the final effect of the drug. So now we've got to start thinking, okay, well, we have some understanding of specific concentrations of CBD or THC, but that subtle differences in the plant composition may significantly affect the drug's ability to treat specific medical conditions. Next slide, pain ladder, extending therapeutic option. So according to the WHO, as you'll well know, if pain occurs, there should be prompt oral administration of drugs in the following order: non-opioids, mild opioids, and strong opioids. Is it appropriate and justified, therefore, so as we increase and we're moving up the pain ladder, we see people's response sometimes to these drugs and having adverse drug reactions to them. One approach could be to consider, is it appropriate and justified to add cannabinoids to improve the outcomes when pain continues to persist or increases regardless of the use of weak or strong opioids? And as we've talked about slightly earlier, is that THC and CBD is effective in chronic pain relief alone and when added to standard opioid therapy. The clinical data is suggesting that's the case. So again, another question we've got to ask is it appropriate and justified to substitute with cannabinoids in this setting? Next slide, pharmaceutical quality. A big question here, a really important question, is pharmaceutical quality. What is pharmaceutical quality? Well, internationally, the quality of medicinal cannabis products can vary greatly. If you look at the USA, for example, you'll find dispensaries. And these provide a range of what's termed medicinal cannabis products, but really are sometimes not much better in terms of their quality than street or illegal cannabis. So the two pictures I've got there are cannabis prepared in a bag for sale, and people generally are smoking that, and edibles, which can be variable in terms of their quality and content, and unpredictable when a patient consumes them. Neither of these are of pharmaceutical quality. From the start, the growth and production of cultivation of a cannabis plant needs to be according to good agricultural practice and good manufacturing practice. There needs to be a defined approach on how that's done, how it's, that it's validated in its cultivation and production methods, so that each batch is equivalent to the next. The production of the finished dose form, whatever it be, either it's cannabis floss, the whole dried flower, or as an oral dose form, again, must be to GMP. Patients need to have assurance that there's quality and that for physicians, batch to batch, there is a consistent profile of active ingredients. When prescribing, it's essential for prescribers that they can make a defined decision about the drug regimen so that patients are consuming the same dose every time. Quality specifications need to be assured as well. So certificates of analysis from an accredited lab, and if you look at the first reference at the bottom of the page, it's a great reference on how accurate is potency testing. Looks at, again, the USA and the role that accredited or supposedly accredited labs have in terms of preparing certificates of analysis to show quality and its assurance of quality. But the variability across these labs and was substantial and really undermined the potential of these as a legitimate medicine. Consistent active pharmaceutical ingredients. So the content of the product, batch to batch, needs to be ensured. There needs to be no heavy metals or pesticides. They need to be grown in controlled environments. So it comes back to that cultivation aspect of GAP, GMP. And the microbial content needs to be at acceptable levels, particularly if these products are going to be vaporized and inhaled into the lungs. Those people with a compromised immune system, this is particularly important. And the dose forms need to be really two, in my mind, of two kinds, vaporization via a medical device and oral dose forms, whether it's sublingual spray or as a concentrated oil for direct oral consumption. Extending that option of dose forms wider to the pictures I've just showed you, particularly around edibles, really is delving into risky grounds. Next slide, pharmaceutical quality. Got a graphical representation here of really the what's available in terms of pharmaceutical quality. GW Pharmaceutics, as I've mentioned, out of the UK, produced Sativex for some years now, and that has been available on the New Zealand market. And it's a sublingual spray under prescription. It has a THC-CBD ratio, an exacting ratio. Epidiolex, which is a CBD concentrated oil for oral administration, is particularly used or has been generated for use in childhood epilepsy, but I expect that it will be used again, like Sativex, off-label. Petrocan BV out of the Netherlands produced two good manufacturing standards, cannabis floss, and that's in the Netherlands is prescribed medicine and typically administrated via vaporization. They're also over there producing oral dose forms to GMP, or soon to be to GMP. AbbVie are producing Marinol, and that's a synthetic THC, like Valiant Pharmaceutics Casimet, which is again Navilone. Synthetic THC, they're prescription medicines and oral dose forms, and you'll find some prescribers are prescribing that as a base prescription, so people are consuming that as a THC component only, and then are taking other pharmaceutics, for example, Bedrocan cannabis floss, to modulate or top up the effects of the THC only dose forms. So, five interesting and slightly different pharmaceutical products available internationally. Each are providing patients slightly different options and prescribers that level of therapeutic option. Next slide, administration. So you'll note here the four most common ways that medicinal cannabis is taken by patients across the world. This data comes from the largest patient use survey undertaken, and it points, firstly, really some very interesting information, but firstly that smoking, inhalation of smoke is the most predominant way that medicinal cannabis is taken worldwide. However, with the advent of technological advancements and the cost associated with vaporization technology, in particular the development of medical devices in this setting, patients are moving away from smoking and toward vaporization. And equally, the second largest intake is around oral ingestion. And again, that's because true patients, don't actually want to smoke cannabis. They want to take their medicine in a more direct and safe way. And everyone is aware of the risks of smoking, regardless of whether it's tobacco or cannabis. So it's a very interesting study, and I encourage you to read that study. It's published in the Journal of Psychoactive Drugs, but really highlights some important facts. And I think that the most important one is that people are moving away from smoking towards vaporization. Vaporization. Vaporization is actually a very interesting concept, and I'll link back again to the earlier slides about Mira Agar's clinical trial in New South Wales, which is looking at the use of cannabis floss by vaporization in the palliative care setting. So it's the most efficient route of administration, and the use of a vaporized medical device, as I mentioned, avoids respiratory disadvantages of smoking. Next slide, vaporization. So I've put this together as a short slide because I think it fully discusses the key aspects. It's absorbed into the lung easily. The dose type really must be of pharmaceutical quality, but importantly, it includes not only therapeutic levels of cannabinoids, but the terpenes are inhaled alongside that. The onset of action is relatively fast, especially by comparison to oral administration. Duration is typically around 2 to 4 hours, and safety is, by comparison, when I say harmful compounds are virtually absent, we're talking about especially in comparison to smoking. So fully standardized pharmaceutical quality cannabis floss provides an optimal medicinal product for vaporization and inhalation into the lungs. As I've said, the vapor contains therapeutic levels of cannabinoids and terpenes. And importantly, the vapor content is rapidly absorbed, improving the ability of the patient, via a doctor's oversight, to adjust the dose and therefore minimize side effects, particularly around the psychoactive nature of the drug substance. next slide, vaporisation developments. So Psych Medical, probably the most advanced medical device available, vaporisation medical device available in the world, and they're using standardised pharmaceutical grade raw cannabis, so the cannabis floss, and they're putting it into these small slides, which are inserted into diskettes or preloaded cartridges, and that's put into a metered dosing delivery system, which is a vaporisation medical device. Fascinating piece of administration technology, and I think this is where if we think back to a few slides earlier, people's want to move away from smoking, but there's still their want to use a standardised raw or cannabis floss. This kind of technology is providing them those options, but more importantly, it provides the prescribing physician with an exacting dose form, so they can tell their patients and assist their patients in the titration of their dosing to ensure that they have equal and comparable dosing every time that they are intaking that drug substance. So really interesting developments, and I think a great step forward in terms of the administration of these drug substances by vaporisation. Importantly, I think when we link back again to Professor Mira Agar's study, it's this kind of technology that's going to enhance the findings of her study and how that relates to not only use in the setting of palliative care, but I suppose more widely out to other indications safely. Next slide, access. New Zealand is taking a measured and cautious approach, and I think that's very sensible given, again, the fact that we are essentially dealing with a new class of medicines. Where is New Zealand at? Well, we have guidelines for use and access, and these have been updated since 2007 to reflect the fact that new information exists, new products exist. Again, it's still on a case-by-case basis, but recent developments have meant that it's moved from the Associate Minister of Health to the Ministry of Health for approval. And secondly, Sativex, while registered for MS, is predominantly used and prescribed off-label. And that has so far provided people at least with one option, but other pharmaceutically derived products will be accessible in this country in the future. So I recommend everyone has a look at the prescribing cannabis-based products guidance from Medicines Control, which is in the link below, and be familiar with that accessibility documentation. I think it's very important that we work closely with the Ministry of Health and support each other as these developments move ahead, because like every other medicine, we need to introduce this in a safe and measured way. Next slide, not a panacea. Yes, indeed, we have had a long human experience with cannabinoids. And among others, the following are widely believed, but are they right? It is safe. No one has ever died, people say. I don't think we can actually say that because documentation may go back thousands of years, but we can't truly, truly say that people have not died from this or been substantially harmed. And while I agree, the intake of huge volumes of this drug product would be required to kill someone, it's still, I don't think, a safe position to be in to say it's never really harmed anyone. Secondly, people should just grow their own medicine, it's said. Well, we have found out that's not true either. And if you remember from the start of this presentation, we talked about that batch-to-batch variability and the risk of pesticides and heavy metal and fungal contamination can result in a more harmful product to patients than if they are accessing pharmaceutical quality drugs. This is a new class of medicines. Yes, there is evidence to suggest that medicinal cannabis, cannabinoid therapeutics, has a role to play in palliative care, and hopefully I've explained that in enough detail. But there is still more to understand, particularly its use in very young children. And I talk more about that from the perspective of epilepsy, but also there is more to understand about its use in general populations. Mira Agar's clinical study will tell us more and be more insightful from that perspective. More clinical data that's arising day to day will provide greater detail about how we use these safely. But given that we are having these drug products being made more available in New Zealand with the recent developments by the Ministry of Health, I think it's still important that we take that cautious approach. And in that cautious approach, we note down exactly how these products are affecting and influencing the disease state and the well-being of our patients. There exists a risk of drug-to-drug interactions, especially within complex disease states that employ a range of medications. So again, like I mentioned, it's important to take a cautious and measured approach and to evaluate the efficacy of these drug substances, and if we find adverse drug reactions occurring, that these are monitored and well integrated. I'd like to be working more closely with the Centre for Adverse Reaction Monitoring to Dunedin to build a better picture of what is actually happening with these drug substances so we can improve that understanding through time. Cautions should be advised also with a familial history of psychosis, just like other drug substances that influence people's psychological state, but also those with heart disease, because there can be impacts there. Next slide. Further reading. So the Einsberg report from article from 2014 is again looking at the psych medical device that I mentioned earlier in the slides here, and that's looking at the pharmacokinetics, efficacy, safety, and ease of use of that novel portable metered dose inhaler. A very interesting read, and if you can't get hold of that, I could probably send it through to you. Very useful, very interesting. Patient use surveys. There's two that I think you should probably have a look at, and one is by Pledger, Martin and Cummings, and that explored in greater detail what I originally conducted for the Ministry of Health around the New Zealand Health Survey. They're exploring the characteristics of medicinal cannabis users in New Zealand, and that's freely accessible via the New Zealand Medical Association from their journal. A very good read done by local researchers here in Wellington. Hayskamp and Herdink, the two Dutch researchers, and they were looking at the prevalence and incidence of medicinal cannabis on prescription in the Netherlands. A very useful insight, looking at the prescribing of not only other medicines, and I touched on this right at the start in terms of the Netherlands, that they are looking at what medicines people were taking alongside that, the dosing that they were taking in terms of their prescribed cannabinoid therapeutics, et cetera, et cetera. Very good short overview. And two clinical reviews that I've talked about in a bit of depth here, again by Hayskamp and Grossman and Carwell, Hayskamp and Grossman. There's more data that's surrounding clinical studies, but these last two reviews taken all clinical studies that have been conducted in 5-year clumps, and so we expect in 5 years time that we'll have another review similar to this. So good further reading and something just a way to start off your further investigation for yourselves. I have a short article I drafted as well around vaporization, which I'd like to share with you, and I will give to the Hospice New Zealand for distribution through your networks. So I'd like to wrap up. I think it's essential we ensure we're working with facts over myths. And I hope I didn't identify the myths in particular, but I hope I've clarified some of the aspects that potentially were myths surrounding this topic. But it's really essential we're always working with facts and evidence-based data. Quality is paramount. There's no doubt about it. Patients shouldn't be accessing substandard cannabinoid therapeutics. Prescribers need to ensure that they are prescribing the best quality medicines for their patients to ensure the best outcomes for them. We need to work within the guidelines for access established by the Ministry of Health and as they develop through clinical research and patient insight. There's no need to reinvent the wheel if it's working well elsewhere. So I think about what are the developments that are occurring in Australia, what can we learn from that? What's happening in the Netherlands? They've been doing this for a long time, very successfully, under the control of their Ministry of Health. And there's new developments occurring in Germany. They're about to embark on a nationwide access to cannabinoid, standardized cannabinoid therapeutics that'll be subsidized by the government. And the information that they generate from essentially what's a phase four study will contribute greatly to our knowledge of its practical use in the community settings. So I look forward to that. I think by 2020 we'll have some very valuable information. Patients, we've got to recognise patients are using it now. The New Zealand Health Survey is showing us that. And that's occurring worldwide. And we need to meet their needs with quality pharmaceutical options. I believe that the palliative care setting is a well-monitored area and a very suitable area for the safe introduction of cannabinoids into mainstream medical use. So I'll wrap up here, and I'd be welcome to take any questions. And thank you for your time.